I wanted to talk a little bit today, as we're approaching Purim, about the Megillah. Specifically, this idea actually is not here today, but David Spiegel gave me this idea. He asked me about the parallels that we find between the stories of Yosef, on the one hand, and Esther and Mordechai that we find in the Megillah, on the other hand. So I'd like to look at these parallels briefly and try and figure out what meaning we can cull from them, what exactly is the message, what messages can we get from them. In addition, today the Beit Midrash is part of the wider Torah Mitzion network of Kolalim, and today is their international day for the study of Machloket L'Shem Shemayim. So we will address part of our remarks in that direction as well. I think it ties in very nicely. So in terms of the Megillah, let's jump right in. There's a lot of points of parallel, you read them, and it's clearly not accidental, between the Megillah and the story of Yosef. There's other parallels to other areas in Tanakh, there's parallels to Sefer Daniel, there's parallels to the story of Yehuda. I want to focus on these points of parallel, and we'll look at two sets here. One are parallels in the narrative, parallels in terms of details in the story. So at the top of the sheet here, I've brought a few of the examples. There's many others. The stories both occur in exile, and they involve, obviously, Jewish characters who are now interacting with foreign governments. Yosef is part of Paro's court. He becomes the second in command. He's interacting with Egyptian society. And Mordechai and Esther are in Persia. They're interacting with Persian society. Both stories, interestingly, include a king and also disloyal servants. In the case of Paro, he has the Sar HaOfim and the Sar HaMashkim, who Yosef encounters in prison, the cupbearer and the baker, and these are disloyal servants. They're put into jail for their disloyalty. In the story of Purim, there's Bigtan and Teresh, who Mordechai encounters plotting to kill Achashverosh. And in both stories, this disloyalty becomes the basis for promoting a Jewish protagonist. In the case of Yosef, his interpretation of the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker is what enables eventually, in terms of the course of events, him to come in front of Paro and him to be promoted into his position. And in terms of Mordechai as well, he reports Bigtan and Teresh to the king, it's written down, and on a fateful point later in the story, the king can't sleep, he's reading the book of Chronicles of the Kingdom, and he ends up promoting or rewarding Mordechai. It's part of the story on the basis of his loyalty, as opposed to these other disloyal servants. Both stories include a protagonist who has a dual name, and also who hides their identity. In this case, the parallel is not to Mordechai, but to Esther. Esther is Hadassah, that's her Hebrew name, her Jewish name, but she's also known as Esther. Yosef as well is Yosef, but he's known in terms of Egyptian life as Tzafnath Paneach, which is the name that Paro gives him. And in both cases, Esther hides her identity from Achashverosh. It's a central point in the story. Yosef as well hides his identity, not from Paro, but from his brothers. His brothers come down to see him, and he pretends to be this Egyptian viceroy, and he doesn't really interact with them in terms of his real Jewish identity. And both stories, again, the revelation of this identity has significant impact on the other characters. Obviously, Esther's revelation of herself is the catalyst for saving the Jews. Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, and they come to understand the whole drama that he has orchestrated, the lesson that he was trying to teach them. Both cases, this occurs during a meal. Yosef's eating with his brothers. Esther is in the meal together with Achashverosh and Haman. So you see, this is so clearly intertwined. It can't be accidental. And in terms of textual parallels, literally the same words, we find that as well. If we look in this second section here, in terms of the descriptions of Bigtan and Teresh and the Sar HaMashkim and Sar HaOfim, we see the same kind of language, Katsaf Bigtan v'Teresh Shnei Sarisei HaMelech, and again, Vayiktsof Paro al Shnei Sarisav, it's the same word, Katsaf, the same description of the servants. In terms of the parallels between the king's program of gathering together women that may be potential queens, potential brides for the king, you see the same kind of language as Yosef's description of gathering together the food in Egypt. Vayafked hamelech pikidim mechol medinot malchuto vayikbetsu et kol nara betula tovat mareh. And similarly, in terms of Yosef, vayafked pikudim vayikbetsu et kol ochel hashanim atovot, you see both Esther and Yosef described with the terms yifat toar v'tovat marah, yifat tor, v'yifeh marah. There's only three characters in Tanakh that carry that description. The other one is Rachel, and that's also significant. But the notion of being beautiful is described in this particular way. And interestingly, as been pointed out, there's a parallel between the descriptions of the women who would be in the house, wherever they would prepare themselves before they would go meet the king, their days of putting on perfumes and makeup would be a certain amount of time, and we have a similar kind of phrase in terms of the description of the embalming of Yaakov, which is interesting, at the end of the Yosef story, so we see that the author of the Megillah is clearly making reference. There's a clear parallel here in terms of the structure of the story. There's a clear parallel here in terms of the language of the story. And the question is, and it goes even further, frankly, if we look at this Midrash in Source 1, in terms of the relationship between Mordechai and Achashverosh and Yosef and Paro, the Midrash says, you don't have to read through the whole thing, but the Midrash says that there is an equivalence between the sons of Rachel. The sons of Rachel, B'nei HaShel Rachel, Nisan Shaveh V'Gdulatan Shaveh. Chazal understood the test of the sons of Rachel. In one case, we're talking about Yosef, the literal son of Rachel. In the other case, we're talking about Mordechai, who's descended from Binyamin, who's also the other son of Rachel. Their tests are equivalent, and their reward is equivalent. And here Chazal point out even more parallels. You see this the phrase that's used in terms of the test of Yosef. Vayhi kedabra al Yosef yom yom. In terms of the wife of Potiphar was trying to seduce Yosef, she would speak to him every day. And in the Megillah, we see the same kind of language is used by the other advisors of the king. Everyone's bowing down to Haman. Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman. And it's the same kind of language. Vayehi ka'amram elav yom yom v'lo shama alehem. They would tell him day after day after day, why don't you bow down to the king? Why don't you bow down to Haman? And he didn't listen. So their test is equated. This is their test. Yosef's test is to refuse Eshet Potiphar. Mordechai's test is to refuse the other members of the court in terms of bowing down to Haman. And ultimately, their gedula, their reward, their greatness is equal, because we find again a very similar phrase. Can't be coincidentally similar, of removing the ring, of the king removing his ring and giving it to this person as an indication of the transfer of power. In Bereshit, you have the description, Vayasar paro et tabatoma al yado, vayiten otal yad Yosef, vayubashoto bigde sheish. That Paro takes the ring off of his finger, the signet ring, which is used to sign proclamations. It's the key to power. Now you can make your own proclamations with this ring. He gives it to Yosef. He dresses him up in royal clothing. And we see the same exact description happening with Mordechai. Vayasar ha-melech et taba'ato asher he'evir mehaman vayitna le-Mordechai. In the Megillah, there's two transfers of power. First, Achashverosh takes his ring off and gives it to Haman. And at a later point in the story, he takes the ring from that he had given to Haman and gives it to Mordechai. And similarly, he's dressed, he comes out, he appears to the Jews dressed in royal clothing. And in Bereshit also, we have Vayarkevoto b'merkevata Mishnah, goes even further. Asher lo, Vayikru lefanav avreich. Yosef was put onto this chariot, and he's paraded through the streets, and they called out in front of him. And similarly, in terms of Mordechai, Natuna levush v'asus, v'kar in terms of Haman's plan, how would you reward somebody? Achashverosh asks them, how would you reward someone that the king wants to reward? And he is also paraded through the streets, and people call in front of him. This is how we treat a king, a person who the king wishes to show his appreciation for. So we see that these parallels are clear. There's parallels in the story. There's endless parallels in the language. Chazal have picked up on the parallels between Mordechai and Yosef. There's parallels between Yosef and Esther. What do we do with all of this stuff? It's very nice. It's clear. But what meaning do we get out of it? One direction which has been gone in, I just want to mention it. It's not necessarily the direction I want to go in today. But one direction which has been gone in is to look at the notion of a Jew interacting with a foreign government, a Jew in a foreign land. And there's clearly a tension in both stories of a person who finds himself in a in a foreign government, and he's loyal to that government. He's part of the government. Yosef was a critical part of Egyptian government. He was saving not only the Jews, not only himself, he was saving the entire society from starvation. There's a tension between that and my identity as a Jewish person. And we see it in Yosef. Clearly, he wouldn't eat together with the rest of the Egyptians. The Torah describes that it was a toeva. He would eat what they regarded as abomination because he ate meat, and the Egyptians did not. But we see this tension appear also in the Megillah, and that's one thing which is very important, which is clearly being paralleled. But I wanted to look a little bit at some of the contrasts between the stories. We see that there's parallels, but there are also significant differences between the stories, and I wanted to consider what the basis for those might be. And I put them here. There's probably more, but I have a few of the contrasts here. One of the contrasts is that in the Yosef story, right, Yosef is the good guy. He is the tzaddik. He is the protagonist. But he's also the antagonist. Yosef creates this whole drama with his brothers. The entire sort of confrontation that happens, the brothers are experiencing this as this viceroy who's clearly punishing them, who's clearly getting them back for what they did to Yosef. This is part of God's plan for their punishment. But really, it's Yosef. Yosef is that person. He creates this whole drama. He creates this whole situation in terms of having this antagonistic interaction with his brothers. We don't find anything like that in the Megillah. There is a certain amount of subterfuge. There is Esther's hiding of her identity, her revelation of it at exactly the right moment. But you don't find, setting up any kind of ploy to, on Mordechai and Esther's part to do something to the Jews to create this kind of drama, the kind of tension that we see in Yosef's story. Another clear difference is that Yosef is constantly mentioning the name of God. Shem Hashem is everywhere. He tells people, in terms of interpreting the dreams, this wasn't me, it was God. The brothers come and say, we're sorry for everything that happened. He says, no, it wasn't you, it was God. Everything is God. He's very clear on defining, this is God interacting, this is God helping me do this, this is Hashem helping me do that. And in the Megillah, that's curiously absent. It's like painfully absent, actually. Even in moments when you really would expect that this should come up, you don't find any reference to the Shema Shah. It's a famous something that's missing from the Megillah. We were shocked when we read it that it's not there. Even when Mordechai tells Esther, that if you don't step up now to save the Jews, then salvation will come, Revach Vatzalah will come, Mimakom Acher. We know what he means, right? He doesn't mean that, some other guy is going to come and say. He means that God is going to save them anyhow. So why doesn't he just say that? It's painfully absent. It's strongly absent from the Megillah. That's difference number two. Difference number three is interesting. Yosef highlights, Yosef is constantly talking about his father. Yosef's descriptions, when he's by himself, the brothers come back, he's asking, Avi, Avi, is my father alive? What's happening with my father? What's going on with my father? There's a recurring theme of Yosef's interest in his father. And in terms of the Megillah, Mordechai is constantly associated with the Am. At the beginning of the interaction with Haman, they discovered Am Mordechai, the nation of Mordechai. The word Am in some formulation appears almost 40 times in the Megillah. It's a seriously repeated word. Am, Am, Am. It's there all the time. Nation. Mordechai is associated with the nation. These are three contrasts which are glaring, which are things that require to be explained. And so the question that I'd like to deal with is, we see the parallels between Yosef and Mordechai and Esther. How do we deal with this contrast? How do we deal with the fact that there's significant changes in terms of Yosef's interaction as an antagonist in the story and that lack with Mordechai, changes in terms of Yosef's constant invocation of his father and Mordechai's more seems to be more rooted with the nation, and also the fact that the name of God doesn't appear in the Megillah, and it appears very strongly in the Yosef story. So to these ends, I'm indebted to one of my Rebbeim, Rabbi Yisrael Herzig, who I learned with for a couple of years in Israel, and since then in different capacities. He gave a shiur about this topic at some point. He was kind enough to send me some of his notes, so some of this is courtesy of him. If it doesn't make sense, then it's what I'm saying. Okay, so what is pointed out is that the Zohar has an approach to explaining these differences between the stories. I didn't quote the actual Zohar because I don't feel competent to explain the actual Zohar, but I have two explanations, two secondary sources which do explain it. The Zohar differentiates between the two sons of Rachel. One of them is considered the Tzadik Ila'ah, the upper tzaddik, and one of them is considered the tzaddik tata, the lower tzaddik. This is mentioned here in the Ma'or v'Shemesh in source number 2. There's a tzaddik ilah, an upper tzaddik, and a lower tzaddik. Yosef is the upper tzaddik, Binyamin is the lower tzaddik. What exactly does that mean? That could mean lots of things. It's fleshed out a little bit more in source number 3 in the Bnei Yisachar. And here he describes that what this means is that Yosef is referring to the masculine side of Yesod, the masculine notion of the tzaddik, and Binyamin is the feminine notion. I don't belabor the physical symbolism, but there's a masculine side and a feminine side, and both of these are called peace. There's an upper peace and a lower peace. What exactly are we getting at? So what I believe is, the Zohar is indicating that though Yosef and Mordechai, or Yosef and Binyamin, the two sons of Rachel, are very similar in terms of their characteristics, in terms of their behavior, there's specific differences between them, and those differences we can see highlighted in between the Yosef story and the Megillah story. So, we'll start with Yosef. Yosef lived separately from everybody else. He was always at odds with his brothers. From the time that he was a child, he had these dreams. These dreams marked him as being different. His brothers sold him. They sold him into slavery. Later, he had all these interactions in Egypt, which were basically alone. And then later, he came back into interaction with his brothers. This highlights something which is important in terms of a person that you think about as a tzaddik, a person who acts perfectly, or he, you know, always makes up for his sins right away, however exactly you want to define this. A person who is like that, who's at that kind of perfection, who acts in that way, is by definition separate. He's different from the rest of the community. He has some amount of loneliness, some amount of distinction, and the question is, when he comes back to interact with everybody else, what is the nature of that interaction going to be like? And in terms of Yosef, his interaction with the outside world is somewhat antagonistic. This explains his desire to mention Shem Hashem all the time. It's not in a bad way, but he's trying to educate everyone around him. It explains his desire to mention Shem Hashem at every turn. He's trying to show the people around him, no, you think this is just happenstance? Let me teach you the truth. The truth is, this is God orchestrating all of these things. When his brothers return, when he encounters them again, he doesn't just embrace them. He says, okay, this is an opportunity. Now I can teach them, I can show them, I can create this drama, this whole situation, which will educate them, show them, I'll see if they understood the error of their ways, I'll see if now they're willing to defend Binyamin, Rachel's other son, are they willing to stand up for him? He creates a situation where he's teaching everybody else, he's educating them, but it's from an antagonistic kind of perspective. It's sort of it's a Yosef versus everybody else kind of relationship. In terms of Mordechai, we find the exact opposite. Mordechai is the tzaddik who is inherently and basically part of the klal, part of the tzibur. And we see this right away in the Megillah. As soon as we open the Megillah, we see, as soon as Mordechai is introduced in the Megillah, his first interaction, his first introduction in source 4, Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan abira, ushmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish ish Yemini. We understand who he is. He's a descendant of Binyamin. Asher haglam Yerushalayim im hagola asher haglata im Yechaniya melech Yehuda asher hegla Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. He was sent out in the exile, which was, you know, the exile which was created, caused by Nebuchadnezzar. And in this source number 5, the Perush of Shmuel di Ozida, which comes courtesy of Rabbi Herzig, he's a Talmud, I believe, of the Arizal, he explains, but just simply meaning, that even though Mordechai was such a tremendous person, he was himself internally a tzaddik, why was he sent away, why was he sent into exile? He was sent into exile because he's part of the group, because he's part of the klal, he's part of everybody else. And this is something which is noted about Binyamin himself, is that if we assume that the exile in Egypt was based on a punishment for selling Yosef, for the sale of Yosef, they had to go down to Egypt, Binyamin wasn't involved with it. He wasn't part of it. He didn't have anything to do with it. So why was he punished as well? It's the same kind of notion that Binyamin as a character is somebody who himself may be internally perfect, but he is part of the group. He is inexorably part of the klal. And we see this again in the last description of Mordechai. Ki Mordechai Yehudi, this is the last, the very end of the Megillah, Mishnele Melech HaChashverosh, great, he's now second in command to the king, V'gadol Yehudim, V'ratzui L'rov Echav, he's desired by most of his brothers, that's a whole discussion by itself, Doresh Tov L'amo, who was he? Well, who was this person? He sought the good for his nation, V'dover Shalom L'chol Zaro, and he interceded, he got involved in terms of finding peace, seeking peace for all the descendants of this nation. This is the description of Mordechai as a person who is intrinsically part of the klal. That's who he is. So what we see emerging are these two different models, two different views of a tzaddik. I think this is the point that the Zohar is making. There's a kind of person who is perfect, but who's distinct. His interaction with the rest of the group comes from a sort of, it seems antagonistic, it's based in the fact that he is distinct from the group, he is by himself and he's educating the group. And then there's the story of a Mordechai, a person who is inherently part of the group. And we see that Mordechai's greatest success, his main educational goal, what is his Musar Shmuz that happens in the Megillah, we see it here in source 7, Mordechai tells Esther, Esther is waffling, he tells her, you have to go, you have to deal with this fact that there's a decree against the Jews, and she's waffling, and he says, Mordechai tells her, don't think, don't imagine, Al tadami b'nafsheich lihimaleit beit hamelech mikol hayudim, that you somehow will survive and the rest of the Jews will perish. Kim hachareish tacharishi beit hazot, revach v'hatzala yamod liyudim b'makom acher, v'at u'beit avich tovedu. Because if you are quiet at this moment, the Jews will be saved, and you will be lost. You and your father's house will be lost. The emphasis here is on the klal, on the community. The point is, don't imagine yourself as somehow you're going to be okay, you'll be the lone Jew, you'll survive over there. We are a community. We are a klal. Inexorably, we're intertwined. We can't be separated. And God will save the community, and you're going to be the one that will be lost. And in fact, the climactic moment is Esther's response afterwards, where she says, "Knosa kol ha'yehudim." She tells Mordechai, "Okay, fine. So if that's the case, gather together all the Jews, gather them together in a unit, and sumu alai, and fast for me for 3 days." And coming back to this point about the lack of Shem Hashem in the Megillah, this is a place where this becomes very strongly emphasized. Fast for me for 3 days. Why are they fasting? Is it a diet? Like, what is the reason for this fast? Are they trying to lose weight? What is the point? Obviously, the fast is a religious concept. They're praying. This is the idea. Let's seek mercy from God so that He'll save us. But there's no mention of that here. And perhaps the idea seems to be that, obviously, I'm not suggesting that God's hand is not at play in the Megillah, but the way that the Megillah is being described, the way that it's being articulated is that at least a large part of the reason why the Jews were saved was not even the hand of God, but the fact that they were willing to unite, the fact that they were willing to come together, the fact that Haman's original statement to Achashverosh, that there is one nation which is Mefuzar and Mefura, there's some scattered nation, they have weird rules, you should just get rid of them, was wrong, that this nation was able to be unified. And this happened as a result of Mordechai's, you know, action. This was Mordechai's way of educating the group. His way of educating the klal was to bring people together to unify them as a whole. So just to recap there, we have Yosef, the notion of a tzaddik who's antagonistic. We have Mordechai, the notion of a tzaddik, a person who is perfect, but his major interaction, his major goal is to unite everybody into one unit. And this, I think, highlights an important theme of Purim, in terms of grabbing something out of this that we can use on Purim itself, is that we think about a lot, I mean, at least this is my personal reflection. You think about the meal, and you think about, do you have to drink, or do you not have to drink, and I'm reading the Megillah, and I'm not reading the Megillah. But it's clear, if we look through the description in the Megillah, it's clear if we consider the mitzvot of the day, of sending mishloach manot, sending packets, sending parcels to our friends of food, of taking care of the poor and destitute, that part of the theme, a clear theme in the Megillah and in the way that we act, is this notion of digging deep and finding a sense of unity, finding a sense of communal unity amongst each other. The Megillah is communicating the fact that this is why, a large part of why we were saved, and the mitzvahs of the day are communicating this notion as well. That's part of the idea that that emerges from this whole analysis, and again, it's part of the notion of Mordechai as a person who unites people in this way. What is an interesting outtake of this in terms of Machloket L'Shem Shemayim? So we can invoke this notion. I think what's important here is that we know there are different ways of interacting with other Jews. Sometimes we have a situation where we believe we're right, someone else is doing something wrong. There's a Yosef model of trying to educate somebody kind of against their will. They get stuck into a situation, you're trying to teach them. There's a Mordechai model of trying to unify everybody together. I think that what emerges out of this analysis is that regardless of how we interact when we're trying to get a point across, trying to educate somebody else in terms of what we think is right, the question we have to ask ourselves is, do I still care about the other person? Why am I doing this? Am I doing this because I want to get them? Am I doing this because I care about them? I want to show them something. I want to better them. I want them to be better. I want ourselves, our community, to be improved. And that's an important point, I think, which emerges out of these two notions of the tzaddik in terms of machloket l'shem shemayim. It's a question to ask ourselves. If we're having a debate, if we're having a discussion, am I still trying to help the other person? Do I still care for them? Is that still part of my goal or part of my perspective or not? At which point, maybe we should ask, is this still really lishma? Is it still really l'shem shemayim? So that's a little bit of perspective on the Megillah. Hopefully we can use it for Purim. Thank you very much.